We continue today our walk through Genesis. And as I said earlier, we arrive at Genesis chapter 9 and we encounter a rainbow. I'll be reading from Genesis chapter 9, verses 1 to 17. Then God blessed Noah and his sons, saying to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth. The fear and dread of you will fall on all the beasts of the earth and all the birds in the sky, on every creature that moves along the ground and on all the fish in the sea that are given into your hands. Everything that lives and moves will be food for you. Just as I gave you the green plants, I now give you everything. But you must not eat meat that has its lifeblood still in it. And for your lifeblood, I will surely demand an accounting. I will demand an accounting from every animal and from every human being too. I will demand an accounting for the life of another human being. Whoever sheds human blood, by human beings shall their blood be shed. For in the image of God has God made humanity. As for you, be fruitful and increase in number. Multiply on the earth and increase upon it." Then God said to Noah and to his sons with him, "I now establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you, and with every living creature that was with you, the birds, the livestock, and all the wild animals, all those who came out of the ark with you, every living creature on earth. I will establish my covenant with you. Never again will all life be destroyed by the waters of a flood. Never again will there be a flood to destroy the earth." And God said, "This is the sign of the covenant I'm making between me and you and every living creature with you, a covenant for all generations to come. I have set my rainbow in the clouds, and it will be the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. Whenever I bring clouds over the earth and the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will remember my covenant between me and you and all living creatures of every kind. Never again will the waters become a flood to destroy all life. Whenever the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and all living creatures of every kind on the earth." So God said to Noah, "This is the sign of the covenant I have established between me and all life on the earth." There is a tree which is a North American pine, and it's called a jack pine. And it's a tree that regenerates and reseeds under extreme conditions. So I don't know about most plants, but you know, most plants grow and then their seeds go out and they regenerate and regrow. But the jack pine will only release its seeds, if you like, after extreme heat, between 90 to 122 degrees Fahrenheit. It's very precise, isn't it? So what happens is the pines that contain the seeds are closed and stuck together, and under extreme heat, the wax melts and the pine cones open and the seeds are redistributed. So often where jack pines are growing, there will have been a time where there was extreme destruction. Either there's a forest fire or something where most of the plants and trees there have been totally destroyed, and the scene seems a little bit devastated. But then after that, over the next few months and years, the jack pines will continue to grow again, because it is under those extreme destructive conditions that they reseed and grow. And here in Genesis chapter 9, there is a similar thing going on. Because in the previous two chapters to this, all we have known is death and destruction, due mainly to the failings of humankind and the fact that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. And because of this, we have witnessed total annihilation, total destruction, total obliteration, complete devastation of the world at the hands of God. Except, of course, for a small group of human beings and a collection of assorted animals that happened to be in the ark, the only survivors of this terrible episode in history. So that when we arrive at the beginning of Genesis chapter 9, things feel slightly tentative. It's true that Noah has come out of the ark and he has offered sacrifices to God. And God has been pleased with these sacrifices and promised that the earth will continue. But at this moment in time, the earth is totally devastated. And life is at an absolute minimum. It's not really a great scene. It's a picture that we would so often find after destruction has totally wiped out areas of land. And yet, here it's the whole earth. But even though the earth is totally devastated, even though life forms are at a minimum and growth seems to be a lifetime away, as we move on into chapter 9 and we look to a post-flood world, we see that amazingly, amid the wasteland that the world has become, seeds of life once again begin to appear. In fact, if you like, you could say we start to see a rerun of the very beginnings of creation. Because firstly, when Noah comes out of the ark, God blesses him and his sons. And then he sends them out into this new devastated world with these words, "Be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth." Almost the exact words he used to bless humans and animals on the fifth and sixth day of the original creation, which of course sparked into life the growth of humankind. Of course, now in these dramatically changed circumstances, things are very different. For a start, the world is not pronounced to be good as it was in the beginning. After the flood, God does not say the world is good, as he did back in Genesis 1. And subsequently, the relationship of human beings to the earth is different also. No longer are they called to fill the earth and subdue it, as they were in Genesis 1, ruling over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves along the ground. Instead, they are now given animals as part of their food source, which creates an element of fear and domination from human beings. And their area of responsibility, instead of simply focusing on the earth and the ground and the plants, is also to now care for each other. God calls human beings to care for each other. Not as, you know, something that's an aside, but as their main focus. So that in this changed landscape, human beings are called to respect and preserve human life above everything else. You see, this period of destruction that's taken place and the subsequent new life that has started to spring up from it has wrought changes on the earth and in human beings that might never have been seen if the floodwaters had not covered the face of the earth. However, the biggest change as we get to Genesis chapter 9, and perhaps the most surprising change, comes not on the face of the earth, but rather in the heart of God. Because you see, as we emerge from the destruction of the earth and we start to pick up the pieces of a new world, it soon becomes apparent that something very dramatic has taken place. Not only have human relationships to the world changed, but God's relationship to his own creation has altered substantially. You see, when God first created the world, when he created all things at the beginning, water and sky and sun and moon and stars and plants and animals, when he created everything at the beginning of time and it was all good, in fact it was very good, God chose to tie himself to creation by moulding human beings, you and I, in his image. So that rather than becoming a distant creator, he became a personal creator who was involved in his creation, forever present in that which he created. And the relationship that God had at that time with his creation, at the beginning of the book of Genesis, was based very much on the fact that things were good. God had created a world that was good. And human beings were there to retain that goodness. They were there to be the image of God on the earth, to bow to him, to trust him, to carry out his will, and to continue to uphold this good world that he created. So when things went wrong and evil came into the world and people didn't uphold this image, God's role as creator of all that was good was to bring judgment upon evil, because it would ruin his good world. Or if you like, at the beginning of time, at the beginning of the book of Genesis, God's relationship to his world was one of creator and judge, until finally his judgment wrought destruction on the whole world. However, now in Genesis chapter 9, as new seeds start to grow and appear, God's relationship has altered dramatically. Do you know, when I was at my last church, I knew a family there who were a lovely family, and we knew each other fairly well. I dedicated their daughter, and their son was in the what would be supernovas in that church, the children's group, and the lady was going to get baptized, and we got on fairly well. We had a fairly good relationship. Things were good. But then, tragically, over one summer, their seven-year-old son collapsed and subsequently died. And I was not the minister, but we didn't have a minister. So I went with them to the hospital, and I walked with them through this time. And I took the funeral, and I sat with them, and we talked a lot. And through that time, my relationship with them changed dramatically. And it will never change back. We will always be tied together because we walked through something so tragic together. Our relationship is forever changed, and we are forever different together. And you know, here in the book of Genesis, although God judged the world and brought destruction upon it, he also went through that destruction with the world. His image was marred and broken and destroyed. And God went through that as well as judging. And so as the dust settles and life begins to return to this ruined planet, and as it becomes clear that actually the world is no longer in a state of goodness that it was, God the Creator has a choice. Does he back away from the world that he knows will continue to always fail? Or does he commit to this changed relationship in a way that he has never done before? Of course, the answer to this question has already been established. In fact, it first appeared in chapter 6 of the book of Genesis, before the flood even took place, when God promised that although he was planning to bring floodwaters on the earth to destroy all life under the heavens, he would establish his covenant with Noah and his family. Or if you like, way before the flood had taken place, God had already decided to commit through Noah to a world that was forever changed. And by committing, by making a covenant, God was not simply making a promise that he would never destroy the earth again through a flood. He was actually saying that no longer would his relationship with his world be based simply on obedience and judgment. Because if it was, he would have to destroy it again, because it was going to fail. The world was no longer pronounced good, and so it would no longer reach the standards that it should. So instead, from now on, God's relationship with his world would be based on grace and mercy. Or if you like, here in Genesis chapter 9, God says for the first time that he will never again give up on the human race and the world in which they live, which makes his covenant more costly than it was before, and which is why we end up at the communion table. And as a sign of this, As a sign of God's changed relationship with his world, God takes his weapon of judgment. God takes the rain and the water that he sent to destroy the earth, and he turns it into something beautiful. He turns it into a rainbow that will forever remind him of his unwavering promise. God puts down his weapon of judgment and picks up the beauty of his grace. And you know, given this context, given this understanding of Genesis chapter 9, it's a real shame that every time we see a rainbow in the sky, we simply see it as a reminder that God will never flood the earth again. Or we actually wonder whether there really is a pot of gold at the end, if we were ever to get there. Two things which actually have very little effect on our daily lives, really. And yet, if we actually took this story, this picture, this poetic imagery, this passage, however you want to see it, and we read it as it was really intended to be read, as a passage which shows God's unwavering commitment to a broken world, not only would we fall on our knees before a God who has promised never ever to give up on us, we would also be deeply challenged in the way that we live our lives today. Because, you know, if we're honest with ourselves and we look around our world, there are so many things that we've already given up on, really. Maybe it's certain sectors of society. Maybe it's certain people groups. Maybe it's certain situations that have been going on and on and on. Maybe it's certain countries that just seem to be in disaster. Maybe it's certain leaders. Maybe it's certain age groups. Maybe it's certain illnesses, people, places, and circumstances that we see as beyond help or unable to change, or sometimes even not worth the effort again. To the point that we've given up so much that we fail to engage with that part of life, and we back away and we kind of live within our certain boundaries that we can cope with. And it's also interesting because as the people of God, we also seem to find it extremely easy, as does everyone else, to judge our world as well. You know, we look around at society, at different countries, at celebrities are a good one, or at different age groups, or at people who stand up to be counted, and we bring judgment upon them as if we have a right to judge people. We write them off in our hearts and our minds. When actually, the God who emerged after the flood, the God who emerged in Genesis chapter 9, our God, is not like that at all. He's not like that. Instead, he's a God who has promised that however hopeless the world becomes, however dire situations seem, however awkward people can be, he will never give up. He will never give up. And not only that, but while the human race continues, his relationship will remain not one of judgment and punishment, but one of grace and mercy and love. Do you know, if this is our God and we are his people, then our relationship with the world really needs to reflect the God that we worship.